Good morning and welcome back to the Old History Podcast, here on part of the Old History Project, where, you've heard it a thousand times, goal here is to just talk about history and maybe make somebody, help somebody learn a thing or two. So the wheels are turning on a few projects here at Old History Central. Between, with me and Warren Doctor, we've been working on a couple of projects behind the scenes, and I expect I'll be able to give you some news on one of them. It's here in Hanlon County. I expect I'll be able to give you some public news on this soon, and I apologize to be so secretive. But some of this stuff, you just have to be careful with what you say, so that way misinformation doesn't get out there, if you understand what I'm saying. But one of the projects is going to be very exciting. I'm super excited to move forward with this, and I was actually one of the reasons why this project is going to move forward into, we'll say, state preservation hands. So I filmed it some time ago, and it was honestly, I think it was because of me, because I sent it to Warren Doctor, and he sent it to Dr. West, and so on and so forth. But I expect I'll be able to tell you something here in the next couple of months. So there are other things moving along. We did find a couple of caves. One of them is huge, and it's a slit in the ground, maybe about 4 foot wide by about 8 feet long. Opens up into a huge, 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 enormous cavern. But it is on state land, and if you're not aware, it is illegal to even go around a cave on state property with a camera or any sort of camping or climbing gear. That's a federal trespass. That's a big no-no. So, other than that, I know where it is. I reported it to TVA, made sure they know about it. Because there are 10,000 registered caves in the state. They don't know where they're all at. Tennessee has more caves than any other state in the union. All right, so moving forward with another project, there's a house out there in Rogersville, big old haunted house, and I'm going to go in and film it when the owners get it cleaned up. They're going to have to tear it down, unfortunately, but I grew up out there in that area, and a cousin lived out there, and I always seen this house, and I've always wanted to go in it. So I contacted the owners, and they're grateful that I've taken an interest in it, but unfortunately, it's going to have to be tore down. But I'm going to go get some pictures of it this weekend, so stay tuned to the Old History Facebook page. So let's go ahead and move forward with the podcast here. And as always, go give my good friend Jason a look-see at the Beard Guy and Friends. And if you want to now, if you want to support your favorite internet historian, go right over here to Anchor, and you can subscribe to the podcast. And lastly, I know there's been seeing an increased number of people in Germany listening to my podcast. So, Gross dich Gott to my German friends. All right, take a quick break here, and we'll get into the podcast. All right, so during the last podcast, we talked about the state constitutions and the Articles of Confederation. And actually, we talked about Congress and the first economic issues for the new country. Excuse me. So we learned how the early founders and the early politicians made various state constitutions that were on one end of the spectrum and on another end of the spectrum. He took and really just kind of conglomerated all that into one that worked for everybody. And so with that, we're going to talk about Shays' Rebellion. We're going to talk about getting the Constitution ratified, and then we're just going to kind of glimpse over the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist papers. And as always, old history does not get into modern politics. Moreover, I just like to see how some of this stuff from 300 years ago still plays parts in today's society. So our ancestors are still taking us to school. All right, so let's dig in. So the crisis of the 1780s, which is what we just went over last weekend, was one of the most intense in the rural and relatively newly settled areas of central and western Massachusetts. And I'm reading this from U.S. History, Mount Vernon, and Bill of Rights Institute. Full credits to everybody that wrote these articles. I did not write them, I'm just reading them. Lots of farmers and lots of business owners suffered from the absurdly high debt as they were trying to start new farms. And unlike the other state legislatures in the 1780s, the Massachusetts government didn't respond to the economic crisis by passing pro-debtor laws, which was basically forgiving debt and printing more paper money. Anyway, as a result, local sheriffs seized many farms and some farmers who couldn't pay their debts were put in prison. So, and this was a real complicated thing. So the government was trying to print more money to pay you back. But if you couldn't pay the government to pay you back, then you got put in jail. And so that's kind of just a backwards justice system that went on there. So these conditions led to the first major armed rebellion in the post-revolutionary United States. Americans resisted high taxes and unresponsive government that was far, far away. This time, it was Massachusetts settlers who were angry with a Republican government in Boston, and rather than with the British government, you know, across the Atlantic. Farmers in western Massachusetts organized their resistance in ways similar to the American Revolutionary struggle. They called special meetings of the people to protest conditions and agree on a coordinated protest. This led the rebels to close courts by force and in the fall of 1786 to liberate imprisoned debtors from jail. But this would flare into a full-scale, almost a small battle, kind of like a revolt, angry mob kind of thing. And then when the resistors came under the leadership of Daniel Shays, who was a captain in the Continental Army, this was the most extreme example of what could happen in tough times brought on by the economic crisis. So they were called Shaysites. Shayites. It's a tongue twister. Named after Daniel Shays as heroes in the direct tradition of the American Revolution. Many others saw them as dangerous rebels whose actions might topple this new this experiment with a Republican government. So James Bowdoin, I don't know how you say that, was the governor of Massachusetts and was clearly in the latter group. He organized a military force funded by Eastern merchants to confront the rebels. This armed force crushed the movement in the winter of 1786/1787 as the Shayites quickly fell apart when faced with a strong army organized by the state. While the rebellion disintegrated pretty quickly, the underlying forces that propelled such dramatic action were still there. It didn't fix anything. The debtors' discontent was widespread, and similar actions occurred on a smaller scale in Maine, which was then still part of Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, and Pennsylvania, and other places. The governor, whose name I can't pronounce, had acted decisively in crushing the rebellion, and the voters turned against him in the next election. So this high level of discontent, popular resistance, and the election of pro-debtor governments in many states threatened the political notions of many political and social elites. Shay's rebellion demonstrated the high degree of internal conflict lurking beneath the surface of a post-revolutionary war life. National leaders felt compelled to put an end to such popular actions that took place beyond the bounds of law. And so that's Shay's Rebellion. What we see here is basically the people were feeling like they had went to war and gained their independence just to go back under the same conditions that they just fought against, and they weren't having it. So, you know, you had the pro-debtor laws, people getting put in jail because they can't pay a government to pay them. And they were rightly upset with it. So, and then we'll just kind of touch on getting the Constitution ratified. But framework for a new and stronger national government had been created at the Philadelphia Convention by a handful of leaders. But how could this system be made into law? You know, they had to convince the public that the weak Central Confederation needed to be strengthened. I mean, could they do that? The articles required, you know, because they were still operating under the Articles of Confederation here, the articles required that any changes in constitutional law be presented to the state legislatures and that any successful alteration required unanimous approval. So they all had to agree on them, which I'm sure could have complicated things if just even one person had an issue. So since the new proposal increased the power of the national government at the expense of state sovereignty, it was a certainty that one and probably several more state legislatures would oppose the changes. I remember that Rhode Island had refused to even send a delegate to the Philadelphia Convention because it opposed any stronger revisions in the articles, much less the sweeping proposal that would end up being produced there. Aware of the major challenge before them, the framers of the new plan crafted a startling new approach through a ratifying procedure that went directly to the people. By this method, the Constitution would become law if 9 of the 13 states approved it. After holding special conventions to consider the issue, they built on a model adopted by Massachusetts in passing its state constitution of 1780. The framers suggested that the constitutional laws was of such sweeping significance that it would be inappropriate to have it approved through ordinary political channels. Instead, special conventions should be held for the people to evaluate such important changes. Politicians in Congress were pretty well aware of the weakness that the current central government and shared the framers' sense that the state legislatures were very likely to oppose the plan. So Congress approved the new terms of this unusual and even illegal, at that time, ratification route. Surprisingly, too, so did state legislators. Legislatures that began arranging for the election of special delegates to the state ratification conventions. This would lead directly into, Shays' Rebellion, Federalists versus Anti-Federalists. And we'll take a quick break here and just go over this. All right, so Federalists, Anti-Federalists. This is from Bill of Rights Institute, full credit to whoever wrote it. So just to kind of step away from all this for a second, just think of how hard things were back then. There was so much uncertainty in the future of the nation, and even what would happen in the next year, or even the next 6 months. Nobody knew. There was a lot of, fear going around as to what was going to happen, because this was a new thing in the world, you know. So everybody was kind of scared. So you had the Federalists and you had the Anti-Federalists. This was one of the greatest debates in American history, and it was over the ratification of the Constitution, 1787 and 1778. Those who supported the Constitution and a stronger national republic were known as Federalists. Those who opposed it in favor of small localized government were known as Anti-Federalists. Both the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists were concerned with the preservation of liberty, but they disagreed on whether or not a strong national government would preserve or eventually destroy the liberty of the American people. So today, it's easy to accept that the prevailing side was right and claim that had you been alive, you would certainly have supported ratifying the Constitution. However, in order to develop a deeper understanding of the ideological foundations upon which our government is built, it is important to analyze both sides of the argument. Now, the Anti-Federalists weren't really as organized as the Federalists, and they did not share one unified position on proper form of government. However, they did unite in their objection to the Constitution, as it was proposed for ratification in 1787. The Anti-Federalists argued against the expansion of national power, and they favored small localized government with limited national authority, as was exercised under the Articles of Confederation. They generally believed that a Republican government was only possible on the state level and would not work on a national level. Therefore, only a confederacy of the individual states could protect the nation's liberty and freedom. Another and perhaps their perhaps most well-known concern was their lack of a Bill of Rights. Most anti-federalists feared that without a Bill of Rights, the Constitution would not be able to sufficiently protect the rights of the individuals and the states. And perhaps maybe the strongest voice of that concern was George Mason. He believed that the state Bill of Rights would be trumped by the new Constitution and would not stand as adequate protections for citizens' rights. Was this concern that ultimately led to the passing of the Bill of Rights as a condition for ratification in New York, Virginia, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and North Carolina? The Federalists, who were led by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay, believed that establishing a large national government was not only possible, but necessary to create a more perfect union. And I'll put that in quotes there, as they did. By improving the relationship among states, as until this point, the common belief was that a republic could not only function efficiently, but it was small and localized. The Federalists challenged this belief and claimed that a strong national republic would better preserve the individual liberties of the people. By extending the sphere of the republic, individual and minority rights would be better protected from infringement by a majority. The Federalists also wanted to preserve the sovereignty and the structure of the states, and to do so, they advocated for a federal government with specific and delegated powers. Anything not delegated to the federal government would be reserved to the people and the states. And in the end, their goal was to preserve the principle of government by consent. By building a government upon a foundation of popular sovereignty without sacrificing the sovereignty of states, the legitimacy of the new government could be secured. And today it appears that the government established by the Constitution is an improvement from that which was established by the Articles of Confederation. However, at that time, the Constitution was only an experiment. Now, just forget what you know about it today, about the Constitution today, considering its unprecedented nature and the fear that a strong national government would be a threat to personal liberty. Would you have been a Federalist or an Anti-Federalist? And the Federalist papers are 100% available to view on Bill of Rights Institute. And so this should just tell you just how difficult things were. Alexander Hamilton, he's a important person here in Hamlin County. He had a house here. It's called Rural Mount. Anyway, just think about that for a second. They had so much going on. They had people wanting states' rights, but then you also wanted people having a national government with authority. So these are all important things to think about when you say, oh, well, it was easy. No, it wasn't. Because I've heard that said a bunch of times, because people don't understand just what happened and how it happened and just what all we went through just to even get to the point of ratifying the Constitution. It was a long and difficult road, but we're not out of the woods yet. Let's see what next week holds. As always, thanks for listening.